I'm Rob.
And I'm Artie. And welcome to Tradesplaining, a podcast that tries to make sense of international trade, business, and expat life without putting you to sleep.
In episode 61, we'll talk about MC13 now that the dust has settled, Switzerland and India and EFTA making trade deals great again, as well as bits and bobs on the EU sustainability due diligence or not, and of course, our old friend Brexit.
More bits than bobs.
Probably a lot of bits. And later we'll be joined by Noelia Garcia Nebra, head of sustainability at ISO, to talk about, you guessed it, sustainability standards, trade, and breaking news on ISO's next Hollywood ambassador. Spoiler alert, it's not the Wonder Twins.
We're winking.
We're winking. And we'll throw in a few points on listener feedback, sneak in our news roundup, and of course, a few jokes.
So let's get into it before we run out of dad jokes, because yes. It might happen.
Or internet.
Well, everybody, welcome to episode number 61. That would be, you'll be happy to know, I'm sure, the atomic number of promethium, named after the famous Ridley Scott movie from the early 2010s.
Didn't see it.
Probably one of the... I saw it multiple times. I actually really liked it. The sequels, not so much.
Didn't see it.
Say it again in case they didn't hear
it. Didn't see it.
Rob, this is about me right now, okay?
Hashtag didn't see it.
Hashtag this entire podcast is about me. Anyway, promethium is not the movie. It's actually classified as a lanthanide. Yes, another one. We're on a roll now. We're just going to insert some DJ Khaled one-liners here when we hear them. It's the only rare earth metal of the lanthanide series of the periodic table not found in nature on Earth. And it was named after Prometheus, actually, the titan from Greek mythology who stole fire from Mount Olympus and gave it to humans.
Bad idea.
So now you can see the connection with the Ridley Scott movie, if you actually saw it. All the isotopes of promethium are unstable, like some presidential candidates. And despite its radioactivity, promethium has practical applications. For example, it's used in luminous paint for watches.
Watches.
Mm-hmm. And aircraft instruments. All roads lead to that. In Major League Baseball, the single-season home run record was held by Roger Maris of the New York Yankees, my hometown New York Yankees. There's also Staten Island Yankees, or there was. Sorry. Anyway, he hit 61 home runs in 1961. 61. So there's a 2-for-1 here. There you go. You're welcome. The record stood for 37 years before a couple of steroid-addled baseball players broke the record, both in the same year and then a few times after that, but they added asterisks. Anyway, it's not important. The year is iconic in sports history, and I guess it's relevant for this podcast because, you know, 61. But anyway, as always, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast to make sure you catch our future episodes, and better yet, you can find us anywhere you get your podcasts, so subscribe to all of them, and do leave a review.
Really anywhere. You get your podcast.
We send one link now with all of the places people can find us.
Fantastic.
So it's been a while, Rob, and I know we haven't heard much on this. Probably my fault because we're busy talking about watches and, you know, Bitcoin. But we talked about a lot of supply chain gluts the last couple of years, as listeners will know, COVID-induced, most of them. We have the opposite now, which seems to be happening, and that is the world has too much wine and farmers seem to be ripping them up, according to Bloomberg. So we have to start doing our part to alleviate this oversupply of wine and make sure that the vineyards can go back to profitability. And I think it's not a lot to ask. Drink more.
Drink more. I mean, do your part, people. You know, dry January is really a burden on a lot of people. We got to stop that kind of thing. And then obviously we need to make sure we're having that lunch glass of wine, the aperitif, and then obviously during dinner. And then maybe a little bit of an...
I didn't read the full Bloomberg article because I'm just a headline guy. But I'm sure Gen Z's fault somewhere. That's what it says in there.
That's a reliable one. Anymore. Yeah, that's a reliable one. Absolutely.
You know what there isn't an oversupply of? Ayahuasca. Thanks, Gen Z.
Thank you, Gen Z. Oh, God. Well, for my part, I've just been to the U.S. of A. And, you know, just a quick one on that, I would recommend you don't watch the drug ads because they go through some really hair-raising side effects, which I'm learning about a lot of things I don't have but feel like I might. Like something called generalized muscle weakness. So I would say fast forward. I mean, get right through those. The other thing was, I think we should get ready because there was a list that we saw, which is super helpful, of wild celebrity requests for when they, for instance, go to concert or in our case, when they do a podcast. So let me just throw out a couple. Maybe you can pick from all of the above. One, this is a bit of a weird one, blue silk curtains and a dozen candles. That's Rihanna. I kind of like that one. It's not bad. Doesn't have to be blue. There's also for Jay-Z, for instance, and he was only one person. He's asking for more than 7 dressing rooms and lots of different kinds of beverages. So that seemed like a good one. You know, we're going to have a lot of costume changes during the podcast. We always do. Celine Dion went a little bit more high road, a private jet, and 75 first-class hotel rooms.
I in particular like Cher, so she has a separate hotel room for each of her wigs.
Yes, exactly.
I would do her one better. I would have a separate hotel room for each of my watches, and then I would have asked, I would probably ask them, I only want the red and the blue Skittles from the bag.
Yeah. And
so I want a bowl of red and blue Skittles. So somebody's going to have to pick out the only red and with gloves on, obviously, because I'm a little OCD.
I mean, let's prepare. And last, of course, Mary J. Blige. Everybody would be on this bandwagon, a new toilet seat every place she goes. We got to have fresh, you know, we need to have, let's say, a new blank canvas to work from.
Sympathize with that because I understand it. I would want new ones, or at least the cover, a new one. Because you never know.
And somehow in the listicle here, it says the cost of this request was $5,000. So these are some kind of toilet seats. It's not quite yet that we're at this kind of level of popularity, but I would say, you know, soon, real soon.
Right now, I'll settle for asking for somebody to close the door behind when we
record. People to keep it down in the front of the house is right now where we are.
Well then, jumping right into stuff that went wrong this week, the important news stories, we're going to do a quick recap of MC13. We had Dmitry Grzebinski and Inu Manek on last episode to give us sort of a preview of what they would expect and obviously making predictions. Some of them came true, actually. So despite high hopes, WTO failed to achieve consensus on a number of significant reforms. It's again highlighting why negotiations like this are actually hard, especially when you're forced to balance national interests with collective goals. And all of this was happening while the world is watching the U.S. dance around its trade relationship with China. With an election on the horizon, how America plays its trade cards, especially with China, can sway voters. So we're seeing that already with the way Biden and Trump are talking about it. This again demonstrates that there's this balance between domestic politics and global trade negotiations on the one hand, and obviously this pursuit of a more, you can say, equitable and efficient global trading system. Rob, you were at MC13. You weren't negotiating there, thank God. But you were there. Tell us a little about it.
Yeah, I think the one thing that struck me was that the rooms for negotiating have something like 300 seats in them. You could just imagine what the challenge must be to actually have a negotiation or a conversation with 164 member countries, up to 164. And of course, not everybody's got the same stakes in every negotiation, but I could see why, just physically looking, why this would...
Some have chickens.
This would be tough. Also, I think we saw there was a kind of minimum for this. Let's say, in my view, there was a kind of minimum. And when I talked to some business folks that were there, the extension of this moratorium on taxing digital transactions was really important. And there was a lot of dark predictions there, even in Abu Dhabi, that this wouldn't get extended. So that was a kind of a win and I would say a minimum. And then, as Dmitry and Inu told us last time, we need to make sure our expectations are reasonable. You know, it's a place for dialogue. It's a place for deliberation. It's not always a place for blockbuster, new, and different stuff. However, there was an interesting article by the New York Times that talked about the fact that there's possible, let's say, light on the horizon with a new way of negotiating called interest-based negotiating, which means folks don't just come with their hard lines, their red lines, their position, but they actually try to listen to each other on what their interests are in the negotiation. And then they try to figure out how to find a solution that satisfies both interests rather than just coming with a hard line or a pre-canned position. And what they say is, even if this meeting didn't get to a consensus on WTO reform, for instance, this has really, really helped. So could this mean things will be move more smoothly? Could this mean there'll be a bit more consensus in the future? Let's see. But the other thing that struck me is this is such an immense show. I mean, there must have been, I don't know, 2,000-3,000 people there. And so much business is getting done in the corridors that has nothing to do necessarily with WTO agreements. So I think there's a lot of value, but it's not necessarily in the headlines about what comes out of the negotiations.
I mean, what I took away from that is that the negotiations are actually like a marriage.
Not much comes out of them?
No, interest-based negotiations. Yes, exactly. Don't come into your relationship with a red line, okay?
Yeah, yeah, thanks. And
it,
yeah.
It never ends well. Moving on, all of a sudden it seems that Switzerland and EFTA, the European Free Trade Area, are making trade policy great again. So Switzerland and EFTA's recent FTA with India, Switzerland, which is a part of EFTA, highlights the complex interplay between economic growth, obviously environmental sustainability, which is becoming a bigger and bigger topic, and the observance of human rights. So the FTA aims for a $100 billion investment and the promise of at least 1 million jobs over the next 15 years, and the investment being from EFTA's part. And the deal, it seems, many are saying, is a clear sign that India is looking to widen its trade scope, cozying up to Europe's smaller economies while also flirting with the idea of deeper ties with the EU and obviously the UK post-Brexit. In Switzerland, Parliament gave a hard pass to dumping their trade agreement with China, even though there are big concerns over human rights issues. I think we've talked about a bit on the podcast. And however, it shows that it's betting on dialogue over disengagement as a means of getting through this. Meanwhile, they're also tuning their pesticide policies to harmonize them with the EU against some domestic opposition and hoping that this gives Swiss farmers a leg up with access to new, ideally more greener pest control options. The one thing I want to mention, Rob, before I bring you in here, is that the best quote from one of the articles I read about this was that the deal is expected to, quote, ease access for companies from European countries to India's vast market in areas such as, wait for it, processed food and drinks, electrical machinery, along with luxury items such as Swiss watches.
Dun-dun-dun-tsh.
I'm dropping the mic and leaving this podcast.
So this is called the Swiss Watch Agreement. No, I think it's a really good example of the Swiss, along with their European free trade area partners, are showing that it's not really necessarily a multilateral arena where the biggest advances are being made on market access. So this came out of nowhere. They've been talking to the Indians for 10 years, and suddenly, bam, this thing comes to pass. And that's a change in interest on the part of the Indians, we'd say. And it's also a leap of faith by the Swiss pharma industry. So the pharma is by far the biggest export of Switzerland. And of course, they're worrying about IP rights, which the Indians have been quite tough on at times in negotiations. But I think the Swiss have decided we want to be in the big markets and we want to have a favorable position in the big markets, China and India, rather than, again, come with some hard lines. I think it's also really interesting to see what it's like to be a small country outside Europe. So the UK can maybe take some notes here. So what's happened is the Swiss, they've been waiting for so long to get alignment with and sort of cooperation with European standards on pesticides, that now the list they could use is very short and they don't have access to certain chemicals that would be available to European producers. And it means that Swiss farmers are at a big disadvantage. So the Swiss really have to kind of find a way to align with the European practice. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way the world works now. So although Switzerland's a small country, some really interesting points about trade coming out of Switzerland. And we know they did, and we talked about a couple of years ago, such an agreement also with Indonesia, where they kind of managed the issue of palm oil in a new and innovative way, but still opened up that huge and growing market. But back to watches.
I was just going to say, obviously, it's surprisingly not about watches. That's neither here nor there. What is here is that the EU has been saying, my bad, and blocking corporate sustainability due diligence amid this general growing skepticism on sort of how appropriate it is to have climate regulations. We call this CBAM blocking. Meanwhile, the Indians are also pushing back in general. Developing countries are pushing back in general on trade negotiations, taking in any other issues besides trade. So again, in keeping with today's theme, we're seeing this tussle between greener policies and the pull of political pushback, which is happening with elections going on in, across the world, whether that's in India, in the US, or elsewhere. For example, the Indian Commerce Minister recently said that trade policy and climate change have nothing to do with each other. He's pointing out that what he sees is a bias in the rich world attempts to mix sustainability with trade deals. He's basically, much like the developing world, calling on the big emitters to pony up and pay for climate change before piling on new environmental issues. It's kind of like going to Five Guys, but having to clean up the table of the person who ate before you start eating your food. It's kind of the situation they find themselves in.
Or you find like half of their old food is actually in your new food.
Yeah.
Like the old ketchup and the cold wiggly fries.
The mayonnaise.
Exactly.
The EU is also slamming the brakes on a law aimed at making companies check on supply chains, I mentioned before. And their fear is that there's too much red tape, which will strangle business. So what do you think about this, Rob?
I mean, yeah, it's really a big turnaround. We've been talking for a couple of years in my work and even on this podcast about coming EU regulations and how they were driving move towards sustainability and how there had to be a lot of adjustment to these things and how they were really leading the conversation. And then this thing happened. So it's not yet fatal, but it's a huge turn away from the push for integration, the push for sustainability by Germany. And it doesn't bode well, as you said, for, let's say, interest in using policy and using regulation to make trade more sustainable. So it's a general pushback against this. And we know there's pushback coming from other places. So we have, of course, the Indians who are very skeptical about this. So those of us who think trade should be more sustainable and regulation and trade policy may be one way to do this, need to be very aware of this backlash, as you say. And it's very real. And right now, all the preparation that countries are doing for this corporate sustainability due diligence looks like it might be a lost investment if they really walk back from this, which maybe is unlikely. But as you say, there's other things. CBAM, I think a lot of developing countries now are hoping for an extension on their ability to adapt to CBAM. Folks are not ready yet. Same for deforestation regulation. Developing countries, this is me talking, not them, I think are very much hoping for a delay in the implementation of this thing because they're not ready yet. They don't have the data, they don't have the maps, and they haven't necessarily thought about how they're going to comply. So there's quite a lot at stake, and those who've decided to wait may have had something, and I certainly didn't anticipate that.
So kicking the can down the road is always a good strategic choice.
Absolutely.
Doing what you were doing before, but calling it a different
name. That's it. Our commitment to sustainability is still strong, but a little bit later. That's how the speech goes broad.
I mean, I know we're making these sort of facetious jokes, or I am, but it seems to be a bit of a chicken and egg situation when it comes to climate change, the policies and regulations and how you balance that with trade, which we've been talking about since we started this segment. What's interesting is that we've seen, obviously, with elections going on, we talked about this is becoming a culture war issue or it's becoming a political issue. So it's basically being divided along political lines, whether or not you agree with climate change or you agree that we should be doing something in terms of a policy aspect to alleviate it. So I don't think that bodes well for getting something really effective done anytime soon. But hey, I've been wrong before.
That's part of what we do on this podcast. We don't look back.
Get wrong.
No, we don't look back. We don't know if we were wrong. We don't look back. We only look forward.
Exactly.
And Artie, there's just one more story, but the UK exports have now reached a 5-year low. They keep going down. This is goods exports, not services.
Who could have predicted?
Who could have thought? I mean, that's just, where is that coming from?
It's okay.
And hey, we want less trade. That was the subtext of Brexit. Less trade, please.
We want better trade.
Exactly. Less, but good quality stuff.
I wonder what Liz Truss is doing these days.
Exactly. Her and the lettuce are both fine.
Noelia Garcia Nebra is a sustainability and trade expert with over 15 years of international experience, particularly in developing countries. Currently serving as the head of sustainability at the International Organization for Standardization, my old job. Her work is dedicated to integrating the UN's Sustainable Development Goals into the organization's strategy and operations.
Before her current role, Ms. Garcia was involved with ISO's capacity building unit, where she addressed standards and regulations, good standardization practices, specifically in least developed countries, and led gender-related initiatives. Prior to joining ISO, Ms. Garcia worked at the United Nations here in Geneva, focusing on trade, investment, and SME development, my current job.
I thought it's middle manager. So, Noelia, thanks for joining us on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. Why don't we start off by having you tell us a little about yourself? How did you end up working in trade and sitting across from us for this interview?
Hello, and thank you for having me here in Tradesplaining. It's my pleasure. All started with an interest in international relations that started during my studies in economics in Barcelona, and that led me to a very enriching Erasmus year abroad, and afterwards to pursue a master's degree on international relations here in Geneva. And that was basically the beginning of my international career, first at the United Nations and then at ISO, working mainly on supporting developing countries. And that's where I came to the realization that there is no economic development without inclusivity and without looking at environmental sustainability.
Excellent. Most of our listeners will know what ISO is, but for those who don't, what is ISO? And I'm asking for myself.
And for a friend.
For a friend. Did I say myself? That was a Freudian slip. Yeah. And how would sustainability fit into ISO's work, broadly speaking?
Well, ISO, or the International Organization for Standardization, note that it's not an acronym, actually. Who created ISO chose the Greek word isos, making equal. so that actually it's pronounced the same way in every language, because otherwise the acronym would change from one language to another. We love to explain that story. Standardizers love to explain that. So it was basically founded in 1947 as a non-governmental organization. And today it comprises 170 national standards body around the world. So one standards body per country. And we work together to create consensus-based voluntary solutions, standards that help improve safety, quality and efficiency across many sectors. Today, our portfolio includes around 25,000 international standards and other documents that are all developed based on consensus. In terms of international trade, I think the best is to refer actually to the World Trade Organization Technical Barriers to Trade Agreement that, on one hand, explains what's the difference between a regulation and an international standard. It's an area where there is a lot of confusion. Both terms are used interchangeably. However, this agreement actually recognized the role of international standards in support of regulation, but necessary to not creating unnecessary barriers to trade or unnecessary obstacles to trade. ISO develops standards based on the six principles that are included in that agreement on how standards should be developed.
So a lot of people would know ISO for things like efficiency, ISO 9000 and so on, things that we don't really associate with sustainability. We think of these things as fixed. So ISO 9000 is what it always was and what it always will be. So how does sustainability come into this, what has been, I think, traditionally very kind of technical engineering-based field? How did sustainability get there, and you know, what do you see as that change in terms of how people use ISO standards?
Actually, standards in support of sustainability exist for many years. For example, the other standard is quite known. It's ISO 14001 together with ISO 9001, which is environmental management systems and contributes organizations handle their environmental impacts. That standard exists since the 90s. It's been part of ISOs for many years, maybe if it's less known, but we basically saw that the trust we can bring in terms of safety can be translated actually to those areas of sustainability also, because again, economic growth cannot be separated from environmental aspects considering sustainability. So this has been part of the natural progression of the work that we do. Every technical community, every technical committee that develops standards has to look at what are the sustainability impacts of the standard they are doing, how are each standard is contributing, for example, to the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So it has been a natural kind of evolution in terms of adapting to the needs of society.
Sure. Basically. But do you see, let's say, of all the standards people are using more and you get a sense of how much they're consumed, would you say the consumption of standards is moving more towards the environmental and sustainability areas?
Yes.
Or is it still more, let's say, the more vanilla kind of standards?
No, a transition towards more sustainability standards, because again, organizations need it to stay relevant in the market today. But consumers are making a lot of pressure, if you want, to have more products that make economic sense, but they make social and environmental sense. And that's where actually the standards come in, because they can bring that security to the consumer, for example, that the product is sustainably viable, basically.
For example, my watches are all ISO certified, my dive watches.
Would you
and
say
that's the main reason I bought them.
Would you say that those are a good example of environmental management?
Yeah, because water can't get in.
Water can't get in. So they last forever.
Exactly. At least that's what the people told me at the boutique. So apart from that stupid example, what are the main reasons that a business would want to get ISO certified in whatever area that may be? Why would an organization go ahead and want to comply?
The first is because it helps organizations being more efficient in their operations. Many of the international standards, ISO standards on management systems, is about making your operations more efficient. And then by being certified or actually implementing the standard, you are giving a sign to the market that you are introducing best practices, that you are thinking about safety, that you are thinking about quality, basically. So it makes business sense for many organizations to implement international standards, particularly where actually, there is, again, more demand for those kind of products and services from consumers, But there is also an increasing push from regulators, actually, for organizations to operate in a sustainable and responsible manner. So international standards help organizations introduce those practices, introduce those operations internally.
I think we do see that. So there's a lot of discussion about various green transitions that are supposed to happen. But the question that is out there is, how do we make sure it's consistently applied? So do you see that as one of the functions that your standards can have? Is that how we recognize whether a company has moved towards a, let's say, more sustainable way of operating? Is that one of the functions a standard can have?
Yes, because international standards can help decreasing information asymmetries and conveying information between producers, for example, across markets, but also between producers and consumers. There is another important aspect that is actually linked to certification is the fact of accountability. International standards, such as ISO standards, are linked to a certification system. So ISO develops also the standards that help provide the certification. We don't do certification, is an important point, because many people think we do certification. That's done by third parties, and it's a very important principle for ISO that certification is done by a third party. But we developed the standards to help certifiers do their job. So that helps with accountability, with showing that what you are saying is actually true. And that's actually a very important point today, where we are seeing big efforts around reporting of sustainability information. How do we bring accountability to those claims? We hear a lot about greenwashing in the context of climate. So international standards can help organizations showing that what they are saying they are doing, it's true.
Now, let me ask you, mentioned ISO doesn't do certification, which is clear. And the folks that do certification charge money to certify. So sometimes it's difficult for smaller companies or companies in developing countries to access ISO standards and to become certified. So the function that you're mentioning is good when it's done at scale. The more companies that do it, the better. How can we make these more accessible, or do you think they're accessible enough to small companies?
No, it's true that the implementation of international standards, and particularly probably the certification aspect, seems very complex and resource intense. But there are different aspects, like first doing a cost-benefit analysis of using the international standard. It has a cost, but there is proof, there is research showing that the benefits are higher than the cost. Productivity, there are some studies showing that productivity increases between 8 and 13%. For example, companies can access global markets, global value change. What I was saying, the signal that gives to the consumers, the quality and safety of the products or services that an organization is providing. What is important is that we actually have a network of 170 national standards bodies that are on site in every country to support the implementation of those standards. And they are well positioned to help organizations, to help SMEs, small and medium enterprises, implement those standards. ISO standards can be adopted nationally by the members. And at that point, the national standards body can decide the price. So to adapt the price of the standard to the local market, to the local context. So that's the value also of the network that we have, that it's really in place, understands the needs of the local organizations and can support with implementation. There exist programs also to support with implementation of standards. And it's also important to say that organizations can implement the standards without being certified, and they still will gain the benefits of implementing the standards, such as reduction in energy consumption, for example, or introducing more streamlined managerial processes, their operations. So that's still a benefit, even if they don't have the certification.
Yeah, we say that the certification is a commercial choice. But the improvement of systems can be something up to that point.
Exactly.
So I guess that leads in nicely to the last thing we wanted to ask on this part of the interview, at least. How do you see this sort of trend going? And second point, do you think there needs to be a balance between stricter regulations or standards for developing countries, taking into the fact that it's much harder for them, as Rob talked about before, to get certified? Do you think there's a balance that needs to be found between the two, or is that the way it's heading or not?
Certainly there is a balance, because I truly believe we need to support developing countries getting there, because otherwise we are just creating more fragmentation and more blocks. So if I can say it like that. But again, international standards, that's where they can help, because they create a general global playing field for everyone. Then afterwards, you can do even more if you want than what the international standard will tell you, because international standards such as ISO, again, go back to the principles I mentioned before, etc., they include the voices of developing countries. And at ISO, we do a big effort to include those voices. So they create this common playing field for everyone. And then afterwards, organizations can always add to that. So certainly there is a need for supporting developing countries getting there.
So I guess that about does it for the serious part of the interview. We can move on to the part that really everybody's looking forward to. So this is the part where we get to know a bit more about you as an expat, since Geneva is full of expats. Many of the people we talk to are expats living abroad. What would be the first thing you learned about your, or one of the things you learned about your home country while living abroad that you didn't know before you left? And I should preface this, so you are Spanish from Barcelona. For example, Rafael Nadal is overrated.
Not at all.
You learned that after the fact.
Not at all.
If you go to Spain,
Nadal is the best. I mean, I have to say, I came to appreciate how easy it is to establish conversation with a stranger in Spain. You will just go to a restaurant or to a supermarket or to buy anything, and will end up explaining your life to.
You mean it's not the case in Geneva with Swiss people? That's surprising.
Wait, what?
A bit less.
I see it. You're going to be a diplomat in the future. That was a good answer. You don't do that with Swiss people. You get yelled at.
Well, luckily, here there are no Swiss.
That's true. Well, I'm Swiss.
Yeah, my point, exactly.
My passport says I'm from Zurich.
So interesting from the Swiss passports.
But enough about me, because I do that enough. Let's land the plane.
Every podcast he says it, but just doesn't mean it. It's never enough.
So I guess more importantly, cut for the next ISO, for the next ISO ambassador, if you had to choose, Javier Bardem or Antonio Banderas? I'm not going to put Nadal in there because we know what the answer would be.
So ISO is about bringing the best experts in each field. So certainly Javier or Antonio will do a great job as ambassadors. But standardization needs good women role models. So actually, we'll go more for Penelope Cruz.
I only mentioned him because I just saw Dune.
I just learned that one.
Penelope is the new ISO ambassador. I'll talk
to her.
She could
be one of the wonder twins.
I'll talk to her.
Connection.
I'll just write her. I'll write her on Facebook.
Great.
Okay. In the spirit of sustainability, we're talking about sustainability here and your role here at ISO and sustainability. Have you considered issuing? Because there's a lot of this out there. Consider issuing standards for recycling old standards. So standards for standards
that were standards.
Or do you have a standard for that already? Because we need to make sure these things are. We have circular. A situation here.
Actually, standards get revised or reviewed every 5 years. Okay. So that's standardized already.
All right.
So every 5 years, we open the process of revision of the standard to make sure that standards remain relevant.
That's what you get for being a smart aleck, Rob.
Who wrote this?
AI.
Anyway, let's get to something that's a little more rigorous. We are, like you, analysts, economists, we were driven by data. So one of the things we do with this podcast is to understand the situation regarding the kebab industry here in Geneva. It's a very important food. It's some people would call the national food of Geneva, which is also, as we know, a canton, but also a republic. So which would you say is the best kebab? There'll be a follow-up here. Which is the best kebab in Geneva? And if you would like some prompting, Parfum de Beirut could be a possible answer here.
But it won't be.
Actually, verification and assurance is actually provided by a party that has no direct interest in the economic relationship between the supplier and the buyer. So it requires impartiality.
Right.
So I'm afraid I cannot give you...
You can't speak to a kebab?
I cannot give you which one will receive the certification.
That's a diplomatic way of saying it's not Parfum de Beirut.
Is that what this is?
Yeah.
Is that what this is?
She's trying to put you down easy, okay? Stop mentioning Parfum de Beirut.
I cannot provide a verdict.
A verdict on the kebab situation. What standard do you think we should apply to, of all the 25,000, there must be one standard that would be particularly good for holding kebabs accountable. Which standard will we apply to a kebab?
ISO 22. 1,000 food security.
Food security.
I was going to say they're also probably waterproof, like my watch. Because you get, they're just it's the worst quality of meat you can get.
Environmental management can also be an issue when it comes to kebab, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's a nice way of putting it.
You have to, especially if you don't finish.
That rule only applies until 2 a.m. After 2 a.m., nobody really looks at that.
Yeah, we only apply. Yeah, exactly. It was a different standard.
Nobody can actually read the rule after 2 a.m. is what he's trying to say. Sorry. So, Noelia, thanks for joining us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure having you on. Before we go, where can people go to find out more about you or the work that ISO is doing?
So the best place is to visit our website, www.iso.org. And you can also find me on LinkedIn.
Excellent. Pleasure having you on, and hope to have you again soon.
So, Artie, that brings us to this week in local news. You wouldn't believe this was true unless you lived in Geneva or really anywhere else.
Or anywhere with an internet connection.
Anywhere with an internet connection, like it wasn't yesterday when we tried to record this episode for the first time.
That's why we're one day late, people. It's Rob's fault.
If we launch on Friday, please still listen. You know, we love the idea of seizures, customs guys getting out there and protecting us and seizing the day. And it happened this time in Lisbon. Portuguese police seized over 1.3 tons of cocaine, which is, you know, that's cocaine. Okay, we stop a lot of that. But something was a little bit, and I would say this is a particular Portuguese twist, was a little different. What do you think was different about this seizure, Artie?
It was smuggled in Cristiano Ronaldo jerseys.
Yes, exactly. Actually, that would have gone through. It was actually smuggled inside, you know, one of their favorites, frozen fish. And I'm surprised they didn't put it in dried fish, the old bacalao trick.
So I guess that's why I couldn't sleep the other night after I had bacalao.
Probably, yeah, exactly. I had bacalao and I went clubbing for the next 25 hours.
I couldn't stop licking my teeth.
Exactly. I was just like, wow, this is the best bacalao I ever had.
Trade finds a way.
It's apparently when it's hidden in fish, it makes it extremely difficult to detect. And in order to remove it, the fish had to be completely destroyed.
So you can't eat the fish.
Yeah.
Okay. So my joke is ruined. Okay. Thanks for that. You could have told me that before I made the joke.
No, I mean, your fish wasn't obviously stopped at customs. That's the joke.
No, there was just a light sprinkling of cocaine on it.
Now, there's another one. Of course, we're going to stick with the cocaine story because who wouldn't? This time, one of our beloved homegrown companies, Nespresso, is the subject. There was an impressive haul of cocaine seized at the Nespresso plant in the Swiss town of Romont, Canton Fribourg. And this is, of course, happening in a very characteristic part of Switzerland. So, of course, the people that were responsible were Albanians. Yeah, they did it again.
Swiss.
In a twist, in a crazy twist. 500 kilograms of cocaine were hidden inside a container of coffee sent from Brazil through Antwerp. But who was the intended recipient? This still remains unknown.
It was for my glaucoma.
Well, as we talked about with Simon Evanett, it was probably St. Gallen. They have the highest rate of cocaine in the wastewater. And we think that...
How do we know that? We just made
it up. No, it's absolutely not. I saw a graphic on TV. That's how we know. We trust what we see on the Télévision Suisse.
Were you on cocaine while watching this said program channel? Are you just imagining
I'm not sure if somebody on cocaine would watch the Swiss nightly news. I don't think it would be possible.
Anyway, I love how the Swiss news article basically says two Albanians living in Lombardy, Italy, in northern Italy, have been arrested. One has already been extradited. Like, didn't you just say two people?
Yes, exactly. Everybody's part of the human. Everybody's part of the human race. Why is it always about Albanians? I don't know. It's very weird.
I don't know. Okay, this is getting weird. At 1 a.m. on April 30th, 2022, now that I'm reading the article, workers at Swiss Terminal noticed two individuals wandering around the containers stacked up in the grounds. Do you know what else happened on April 30th, 2022? No. My birthday. Just saying. Gotta go in. You know, could have been.
And that was the night you went clubbing.
That was my birthday.
That was the night you went clubbing for 25 hours after eating bacalao.
It's coincidences do happen, just not in this case.
So, Artie, we're journalists. We'll keep an eye on local news for the stories that affect you the most. Well, folks, that wraps up episode 61, brought to you by Rob walking like Zendaya. And just visualize that, please. MC13, some is described as a meeting that could have been an email. a Swiss trade policy catching fire, and of course, Portuguese cocaine hiding in bacalhau. We also want to thank Noelia Garcia Nebra from ISO for joining us to talk all things sustainability and trade, and to help us move the ball forward on ISO watch standards.
That's right. We also want to thank our executive producer, Michelle Olguin, and Armina Sinani, as well as Angela Minhu, for helping us highlight the Vyship, as well as in helping produce this and every TS episode. Special thanks once again to Michelle, Armina, and Angela. And also, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't done so already, and make sure you catch our next episode coming out very soon. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. There is not enough time left for me to list them all. So don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We do read all of them, so please be gentle. You can also follow us on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Tradesplaining, or on Instagram at trade.splaining, or email us your questions, comments, the old-fashioned way at trade.splaining@gmail.com. Once again, that's trade.splaining@gmail.com. And also, please stop with the AI-generated emails. Just send the normal one.
And be sure to mention in your review the bewildering absurdities that you've been experiencing. And of course, listen responsibly.